Sarah was keeping the path open, leading them in, riding just ahead of Jake's car, laying about her viciously with a long quirt of hippo hide to hold back the mob, while around her wheeled the wildly excited riders, still firing their pieces into the air, and dozens of runners pressed in closely, trying to climb aboard the moving cars. Gradually, the press of bodies and animals built up, until at last, following Sarah, they moved slowly through the open forest that surrounded the wells into one of the shallow but steeply sided wadis in the broken ground beyond. Here, any further forward movement became impossible. The wadi was choked solidly with humanity. Even the steep earthen sides and the ledges above were crowded so closely that unfortunates, pushed by those behind, could no longer keep their position and came tumbling down the sheer sides onto the heads of those in the wadi below. The cries of protest were lost in the general hubbub. From each of the turrets, the heads of the four drivers appeared timidly, like gophers, peering out of their holes. They made helpless signs and expressions at each other, unable to communicate in the uproar. Sarah leapt from the back of the plunging stallion onto the sponson of Jake's car and began raining blows and kicks on those who were still attempting to climb aboard the vehicle. She was enjoying herself immensely, Jake realized, as he noticed the battle lust in her eyes and heard the crack of her whip and the yelps of her victims. He thought of trying to restrain her, and then discarded the idea as being highly dangerous. Instead, he looked about distractedly for some other means to subdue the boisterous welcome, and noticed for the first time the entrances to numerous caves in the sides of the wadi. From a number of these dark openings now poured a body of men, wearing a semblance of uniform, jodhpurs and baggy khaki tunics, their chests crossed with bandoliers of ammunition, puttied calves and bare feet, high turbans bound around their heads, and Mauser rifles swinging heartily, the butts used as clubs. They were every bit as enthusiastic as Sarah, but considerably more successful in their attempts to quieten the crowd. "My grandfather's guards," Sarah explained to Jake, still panting and grinning happily from her recent exertions. "I'm sorry, Jake, but sometimes my people get excited."
"Yeah," said Jake. "So I noticed."
With gun butts rising and falling, the guards cleared a space around the four laden vehicles, and the noise dropped in volume until it was equivalent to a medium-sized avalanche. The four drivers climbed warily down and came together in a defensive group in the small stretch of open ground before the caves. Vicky Camberwell placed herself strategically between Jake and Gareth, behind the lanky robed figure of Gregorius, and she felt even more secure when Sarah slipped up beside her and took her hand.
"Please do not worry," she whispered. "We are all your friends."
"You could have fooled me, honey,"
Vicky smiled back at her, and squeezed the slim brown hand. At that moment, a procession emerged from the caves, headed by four coal-black priests of the Coptic Christian Church, in their gaudy robes, chanting in Amharic, swinging incense and carrying ornate, if crudely wrought, bronze crosses. Immediately after the priests followed a figure so tall and thin as to appear a caricature of the human shape. A long, flowing shamar of yellow and red stripes hung loosely on the gaunt frame. There was the suggestion of legs as long and thin as those of an ostrich beneath the skirts of the robe, as he strode forward, and the man's dark head was completely bald of hair. No beard or eyebrows, just a round, glistening pate. His eyes were completely enclosed in a web of deep wrinkles and fleshy folds of old, dried-out skin. The mouth was utterly toothless, so that the jaw seemed to be collapsible, folding the face in half like the bellows of a concertina. He gave the impression of vast age that was offset immediately by the youthful spring in his step and the twinkle in the black, bird-like eyes. And yet Gareth realized that he could not be less than 80 years old. Gregorius hurried forward and knelt briefly for the old man's blessing, while Sarah whispered to the group,
"This is my grandfather, Ras Ghulam," she explained. "He speaks no English, but he's a great nobleman and a mighty warrior, the bravest in all Ethiopia."
The Ras ran a lively eye over the group and selected Gareth Swales, resplendent in thorn-proof tweeds. He leapt forward and, before Gareth could avoid it, enfolded him in an embrace that was redolent of powerful native tobacco, wood smoke and other heady odours.
"How do you do?" shouted the Ras.
His only words of English.
"My grandfather is a great lover of the English," explained Gregorius,
as Gareth struggled in the Ras's embrace.
"That is why all his sons and grandsons are sent to England. He has a decoration which makes him an English milord," Sarah told him proudly,
and pointed to her grandfather's chest, where nestled a star of Gordian enamel and shiny paste chips. Noticing the gesture, the Ras released Gareth and invited them to admire the decoration, and on his other breast, a rosette of tricolour silk, in the centre of which was framed a miniature of the old Queen Victoria herself.
"Tremendous, old boy! Absolutely tremendous,"
Gareth agreed, as he readjusted the lapels of his jacket and smoothed back his hair.
"When he was a young man, my grandfather did a great service to the Queen, and that is why he is now an English my lord," Sarah explained.
And then she broke off to listen to her grandfather and to translate.
"My grandfather welcomes you to Ethiopia and says that he is proud to embrace such a distinguished English gentleman. He has heard from my father of your fame as a warrior, that you bear the great Queen's medal for courage."
"Actually, it was Georgie Five's gong," Gareth demurred modestly. At that moment, the dignified figure of Lige Mikhail Sagud stepped from the entrance of the cave behind the Ras. "My father recognizes only one English monarch, my dear Swales," he explained quietly. "It is useless to try to convince him that she has passed away." He shook hands with all three of them, with a quick word of welcome for Jake and Vicky, before turning back to listen to the Ras again. "My father asks if you have brought your medal. He wishes you to wear it, when you and he ride into battle side by side against the enemy." And Gallus's expression changed.
"Now, hold on there, old fellow," he protested.
Gareth had no intention of riding into another battle in his life, but the moment had passed, and Ras was shouting orders to his guard. In response, they clambered aboard their armoured cars and began unloading the wooden cases of weapons and ammunition, which they stacked in the clearing before the caves, beating back the eager crowds that pressed forward. Now the priests came forward to bless the cars and weapons of war, and Sarah took the opportunity to pull Vicky away and lead her unobtrusively to one of the caves.
"My servant will bring you water to bathe," she whispered. "You must look beautiful for the feast. Perhaps we will decide which one it will be tonight."
As night fell, so the entire following of Ras Golan gathered in the main wadi, those ranking highest, or with most push, managing to find seating in the large central cave, while the others filled the valley with row upon row of seated and robed figures. The whole scene was lit by leaping bonfires. The fires reflected against the night sky with a faint orange glow, which Major Luigi Castellani noticed at a distance of 20 kilometres from the wells. He halted the column, climbed up on the roof of the leading truck to study this phenomenon, uncertain at first if the light of the fires was some freak afterglow of the sunset, but soon realizing that this was not the case. He jumped down and snapped at the driver, "Wait for me," before striding rapidly back along the long column of tall canvas-coloured trucks to where the command car stood at the centre.
"My colonel,"
Castellani saluted the sulking figure of the count, who slumped on the rear seat of the Rolls with one hand thrust into the front of his unbuttoned tunic, much like the defeated Napoleon returning from Moscow. Aldo Billy had not yet recovered from the shock to his pride and self-esteem inflicted by the general. He temporarily withdrawn from the vulgar world, and he did not even look up as Castellani made his report.
"Do what you think correct in the circumstances,"
he muttered without interest.
"Only make it certain we have control of the wells before dawn."
And the count turned his head away, wondering if Mussolini had yet received his cable. What Castellani thought correct in the circumstances
was to darken the column immediately and put his entire battalion in a state of instant readiness. No lights were to be shown in any circumstances, and a rigorous silence was imposed. The column now advanced at little more than a walking speed, with each driver personally warned that engine noise was not to exceed idling volume. All the men had been alerted and rode now in silence, with loaded weapons and tense nerves. When at last the Eritrean guides pointed out to Castellani the shallow forested valley below them, there was sufficient light from the silver moon overhead for Castellani to survey the ground with an eye of an old professional. Within 10 minutes he'd planned his dispositions, decided where to hold his motor pool and main bivouac, where to sight his machine guns, place his mortars, and lay his rifle trenches. The colonel grunted his agreement without even looking up. And quietly the major gave the orders, which would put into effect his plans and keep the battalion working all night. "And the first man who drops a shovel or sneezes, I will strangle with his own guts," he warned, as he glanced apprehensively at the faint glow that emanated from amongst the low, dark hills beyond the wells. In the main cave, the air was so thick and warm and moist that it lay upon the company like a wet woolen blanket. In the uneven light of the fires, it was impossible to see from one end to the other of the cavernous room, with its rough earthen walls and columns. The restless body of guests and servants flitted through the smoky gloom like wraiths. Every once in a while, there'd be the terrified bellows of an ox from the wadi outside the main entrance of the cave. The bellows would cease abruptly, as the blockman swung his long two-handled sword and the carcass fell with a thud that seemed to reverberate through the cavern. A vast shout of approval greeted the fall of the beast, and a dozen eager assistants flayed the hide, hacked the flesh into bloody strips, and piled them onto huge platters of baked clay. The servants staggered into the cave, bearing the laden platters of steaming, quivering meat. The guests fell upon it, men and women alike, snatching up the bleeding flesh, taking an end between their teeth, pulling it tight with one hand, and hacking free a bite-sized piece with a knife, grasped in the other. The flashing blade passed a mere fraction from the end of the diner's nose, and warm blood had trickled unheeded down the chin, as the lump was swallowed with a single convulsive heave of the throat. Each mouthful was washed down into the belly, with a swig of the fiery Ethiopian tej, a brew made from wild honey, a liquid the colour of golden amber, with the impact of a charging buffalo bull. Gareth Swales sat between the old Russ and Lige Mikel in the place of honour, while Jake and Vicky were a dozen places further away, amongst the lesser notables. In deference to the appetite and tastes of foreigners, they were offered in place of raw beef an endless succession of bubbling pots, containing the fiery casseroles of beef, lamb, chicken, and game that are known under the inclusive title of what. These highly spiced, peppery, but delicious concoctions were spooned out onto thin sheets of unleavened bread and rolled into a cigar shape before eating. Lige Mikel warned his guests against the tej, and instead offered Bollinger champagne, wrapped in wet sacking, to lower its temperature. There was also pinch-bottle Hague, London dry gin, and a vast array of liqueurs, Grand Marnier, yellow and green chartreuse, Dom Benedictine, and the rest. These incongruous beverages in the desert reminded the guests that their host was wealthy beyond the normal concept of wealth. The lord of vast estates and, under the emperor, the master of many thousands of human beings. The Russ sat at the head of the feast, with a war bonnet of lion's mane covering his bald pate. It made a startling but rather moth-eaten wig, for it was 40 years since the Russ had slain the lion, and the ravages of time were apparent. Now the Russ cackled with laughter as he rolled a sheet of the unleavened bread, filled with steamy wat, into the shape and size of a Havana cigar, and thrust it, dripping juice, into Gareth Swales' unprepared mouth. "You must swallow it without using your hands," Lige Mikel explained hastily. "It is a game my father enjoys." Gareth's eyes bulged,
His face turned crimson with lack of air, and the bite of chili sauce. Gulping and gasping and chewing manfully, he struggled to ingest the huge offering. The Ras hooted merrily, drooling a little saliva from the toothless mouth, his entire face a network of moving wrinkles, as he encouraged Gareth with cries of, "How do you do? How do you do?" At last, with his dignity in shreds, red-faced, sweating and panting laboriously, the roll of bread disappeared down Gareth's straining throat. The Ras folded him once more in that brotherly embrace, and Lige Mikel poured another goblet full of Bollinger for him. However, Gareth, who did not enjoy being the butt of anyone's joke, freed himself from the Ras, pushed the glass aside, and waved one of the servants to him. From the reeking, bloody platter, he selected a strip of raw beef, almost as thick as his wrist and as long as his forearm. Without warning, he thrust one end of it into the Ras's gaping, toothless mouth. "Suck on that, you old bastard," he shouted. And the Ras stared at him with startled, rheumy, bloodshot eyes. Then, although he was unable to smile because of the long red strip that hung from his lips like some huge, swollen tongue, the Ras's eyes turned to slits in a mask of happy wrinkles. His jaw seemed to unhinge like a python swallowing a goat. He gulped an inch of the meat, shot into his mouth. He gulped again, and another inch disappeared. Gareth stared at him as gulp succeeded gulp, and swiftly the morsel dwindled in size. Within seconds, the Ras's mouth was empty, and he snatched up a bowl of Tej and drank half a pint of the heady liquor, wiped blood and Tej from his chin with the skirt of his shammer, belched like an airlocked geezer, then with a falsetto cackle of merriment, hit Gareth a resounding crack between the shoulder blades. In the Ras's view, they were now comrades of the soul, both English aristocrats, renowned warriors, and each had eaten from the other's hand. Gregorius Mariam had anticipated exactly what his grandfather's reaction to his white guests would be. He knew that Gareth's nationality and undoubted aristocratic background would overshadow all else in the Ras's estimation. However, the young prince's feelings for Jake Barton had become close to adulation, and he did not intend that his hero should be ignored. He chose the one subject which he knew would engage his grandfather's full attention. He slipped unnoticed from the din of the overcrowded cave, and when he returned he carried Jake's stiff, crackling lion skin that had by now completely dried out in the hot, dry desert wind. Although he held it high above his head, the tail brushed the ground on one side and the nose on the other. The Ras, one arm still around Gareth's shoulder, looked up with interest and fired a string of questions at his grandson as the boy spread the huge tawny skin before him. The replies made the old man so excited that he leapt to his feet and grabbed his grandson by one arm, shaking him agitatedly as he demanded details. Gregorius replied with as much animation, his eyes shining, as he mimed the charge of the lion and the act of hurling the bottle and the crushing of its skull. Comparative silence had fallen over the smoky, dim-lit cavern, and hundreds of guests craned forward to hear the details of the hunt. In that silence, the Ras walked down to where Jake sat, stepping without looking into various bowls of food and kicking over a jug of Tej. He reached the big, curly-headed American and lifted him to his feet. "How do you do?" he asked, with great emotion, tears of admiration in his eyes for the man who could kill a lion with his bare hands. 40 years before, the Ras had broken 4 broad-bladed spears before he'd put a blade into the heart of his own lion. "Never better, friend," Jake grunted, clumsily with embarrassment, and the Ras embraced him fiercely before leading him back to the head of the board. Irritably, the Ras kicked one of his younger sons in the ribs, forcing him to vacate the seat on his right hand, where he now placed Jake. Jake looked across at Vicky and rolled his eyes helplessly as the Ras began to ladle steaming what onto a huge white round of bread and roll it into a torpedo that would have daunted a battle cruiser. Jake took a deep breath and opened his mouth wide as the Ras lifted the dainty morsel the way an executioner lifts his sword. "How do you do?" he said, and with another hoot of glee, thrust it into the hilt. The colonel and all the officers of the 3rd Battalion were exhausted from long hours of forced march, and by the time they reached the wells of Chaldee, were anxious only to see their tents erected and their cots made up. After that, they were quite content that the major be left to use his own initiative. Castellani sighted his 12 machine guns in the sides of the valley, where they commanded a full arc of fire, and below them he placed his rifle trenches. The men sank the earthworks swiftly, and with little noise in the loose sandy soil, and they buttressed their trenches and machine gun nests with sandbags. The mortar company he held well back, protected by both rifle trenches and machine gun nests, from where they could drop their mortar bombs across the whole area of the wells with complete impunity. While his men worked, Castellani personally paced out distances in front of his defences and supervised the placing of the painted metal markers so that his gunners would be able to fire over accurately arranged sights. Then he hurried back to chivvy along the ammunition parties, who staggered up in the darkness, slipping in the sandy soil and cursing softly, but with feeling, under the burden of the heavy wooden cases. All that night he was tireless, and any man who laid down his shovel for a few minutes of rest took the risk of being pounced upon by that looming figure, the stentorian voice restrained to a husky but ferocious whisper, and the rolling swagger, tense with suppressed outrage. At last, the squat machine guns, with their thick, water-jacketed barrels, were lowered down into the new excavations and set up on their tripods. Only after Castellani had checked the traverse of each and sighted down through the high sliding rear sight into the moonlit valley was he satisfied. The men flung themselves down to rest, and the major allowed the kitchen parties to come up with canteens of hot soup and bags of hard black bread. Gareth Swales felt bloated with food and slightly bleary with the large quantities of lukewarm champagne which Lige McHale had pressed upon him. On one side, the Ras and Jake had established a rapport that overcame the language barrier. The Ras had convinced himself that as Americans spoke English, they were English, and that Jake, as a lion killer, was clearly a member of the upper stratum of society. In short, a kind of honorary aristocrat. Every time the Ras drained another pint of Tej, Jake became more socially acceptable, and the Ras had drained many pints of Tej by this stage. The atmosphere was indeed so jovial and aflame with bonhomie and camaraderie that Gareth felt emboldened to ask, on behalf of the partnership, the question that had been burning his tongue for the last many hours. "Toffee, old lad, have you got the money ready for us?" The prince seemed not to have heard, but refilled Gareth's glass with champagne and leaned across to translate one of Jake's remarks for his father, and Gareth had to take his arm firmly. "If it's all right with you, we'll take our wages and trouble you no more. Ride off into the sunset with violins playing and all that rot." "I'm glad you raised the point," Toffee nodded thoughtfully, looking anything but glad. "There are some things we have to discuss." "Listen, Toffee, old son, there's absolutely nothing to discuss. All the discussing was done long ago. Now don't upset yourself, my dear fellow." It was, however, in Gareth's nature to become very agitated when someone who owed him money wanted to discuss things. The usual subject of discussion was how to avoid making payment, and Gareth was about to protest volubly and loudly when the Ras chose that moment to rise to his feet and make a speech. This caused a certain amount of consternation, for the Ras's legs had been turned by large quantities of Tej to the consistency of rubber, and it required the efforts of two of his guardsmen to get him to his feet and keep him there. However, once up, he spoke with clarity and force, while Lige McHale translated for the benefit of the white guests. At first, the Ras seemed to wander. He spoke of the first rays of the sun touching the peaks of the mountains, and the feel of the desert wind in a man's face at noon. He reminded them of the sound of the birth cry of a man's firstborn child, and the smell of the earth turning under the plough. Gradually an attentive silence fell upon his unruly audience, for the old man had still a power of force that demanded complete respect. As he went on, so a greater dignity invested him. He shrugged off the supporting hands of his guard and seemed to grow in stature. His voice lost the querulous tremor of age and took on a more compelling ring. Jake did not need the prince's translation to know that he was speaking of a man's pride and the rights of a free man, the duty of a man to defend that freedom with life itself, to preserve it for his sons and their children. And now there comes a powerful enemy to challenge our rights as free men. An enemy so powerful, armed with such terrible weapons, that even the hearts of the warriors of Tigra and Shoa shriveled in their breasts like diseased fruit. The old Ras was panting now, and a scanty sweat trickled from under the tall Lani headdress and ran down the wrinkled black cheeks. But now, my children, powerful friends have come to stand beside us. They have brought to us weapons as powerful as those of our enemies. No longer must we fear. Jake realized suddenly what pathetic store the Ras had placed in the worn and obsolete war materials they'd brought him. He talked now of meeting the mighty armies of Italy on even terms. Abruptly, Jake felt a choking sense of guilt. He knew that a week after he left, the four armored cows would be piles of junk. There was no man in all the Ras's following who could keep their elderly and temperamental engines running. Even if they were brought into action before the engines expired, they would present a threat only to unsupported infantry. The moment they engaged with Italian armor, they would be instantly and hopelessly outclassed. Even the light Italian CV-3 tanks would be immune to the fire of the Vickers guns that the cars mounted, while in return, the thin steel of the cars would offer no protection from the 50mm armor-piercing shell that the enemy fired. There would be no one to explain all this to the Ras and teach him how to achieve the best from the puny weapons he commanded. Jake visualized the first and probably the last battle that Ras Ghulam would fight. Scorning maneuver and strategy, he would certainly throw in all his force, armored cars, Vickers machine guns, obsolete rifles and swords, in a single frontal attack. This was the way he'd fought all his battles, and the way he would fight the last. Jake Barton felt his heart go out to the ancient, the gallant, who stood now shouting a challenge to a modern military power, prepared to defend to the death what was his. Jake felt a curious sense of recklessness. It was a reaction that he knew well, and usually it led him into positions of acute discomfort and danger. "Forget it," he told himself firmly. "It's their war. Take the money and run." Then suddenly he looked across the dimly lit cave to where Vicky Camberwell sat. She listened to the old Ras with misty eyes, and her expression was enchanted as she leaned her golden head close to the dark curly head of Sara Sagud, not wanting to miss a word of the translation. Now she saw Jake watching her, and she smiled and nodded vehemently, almost as though she had read his doubts. "Leave Vicky also?" Jake wondered. "Leave them all? Run with the gold?" He knew that nothing would induce Vicky to leave with them. For her, the story was here. Her involvement was complete, and she would stay to the end, the inevitable end. The smart thing was to go, the dumb thing to stay and fight another man's war that was already lost before it had begun. The dumb thing was to stake $20,000, which was his share of the profits, and all his future plans, the Barton engine and the factory to build it, against the remote chance of winning a lady who promised to be a lifetime of trouble once she was won. "I never was a deb hand at doing the smart thing," Jake thought ruefully, and smiled back at Vicky. The Ras was suddenly silent, panting with the force of his feelings and the effort of voicing them. His listeners were mesmerized also, staring at the thin-robed figure with its wild lion wig. The Ras made a commanding gesture, and one of his guards handed him the broad two-handed sword, its blade long and naked. The Ras leaned his weight upon it and commanded again, and they carried in the war drums, the Ras's ceremonial drums, passed down to him by his father and his father before him, drums that had beaten at Magdala against Napier, at Adowa against the Italians, and at 100 other battles.
They were as tall as a man's shoulder, elaborately carved of hardwood and covered with raw hide, and the drummers took up their stance with the barrels of their drums held between their knees. The drum with the deepest bass tone set the rhythm, and the lesser drums joined in with the variations and counterpoints, a chorus that jarred a man's gut and loosened his brain and his skull. The old Ras listened to it with his head bowed over the sword, until the rhythm took a hold on him, and his shoulders began to jerk and his head came up. With a leap like a white bird taking flight, he landed in the open space behind the drummers. The great sword whirled high above his head, and he began to dance. Gareth took Miguel Zagud by the sleeve and lifted his voice in competition with the drums, and resumed at the point where he'd been interrupted.
Toffee, you were telling me about the money.
Jake heard him and leaned across to catch the prince's reply. But the prince was silent, watching his father leap and twirl in the intricate and acrobatic dance.
We've delivered the goods, old chap, and a deal is a deal.
15,000 sovereigns, said the prince thoughtfully.
That's the exact figure, Gareth agreed.
A dangerous sum of money, murmured the prince.
Men have been killed for much less.
And they made no reply.
I think of your safety, of course, the prince went on. Your safety and my country's chances of survival.
Without an engineer to maintain the cars, and a soldier to teach my men to use the new weapons, we will have wasted 15,000 sovereigns.
I feel very badly for you, Gareth assured him. I'll eat my heart out for you while I'm having dinner at the Café Royal. I really will. But truly, Toffee, you should have thought of this long ago.
Oh, I did, my dear Swales. I assure you, I gave it much thought.
And the prince turned to smile at Gareth.
I thought that no one would be foolish enough to take on his person 15,000 gold sovereigns in the middle of Ethiopia and then try to get out of the country without the Rasi's personal approval and protection.
They stared at him.
Can you imagine the delight of the Shifta, the mountain bandits, when they learned that such a prize was moving unprotected through their territory?
They would know, of course, murmured Jake.
I fear that they might be informed.
The prince turned to him.
And if we try to go back the way we came?
Through the desert on foot?
The prince smiled.
We might use a little of the gold to buy camels, Jake suggested.
I fancy you might find camels hard to come by. And somebody might inform the Italians and the French of your movements,
to say nothing of the Danakil tribesmen, who would slit the throats of their own mothers for a single gold sovereign.
They watched the Ras send the great sword humming 6 inches over the heads of the bass drummers, and then turn a grotesque flapping pirouette.
God, said Gareth.
I took you at your word, Toffee. I mean word of honour.
An old school.
My dear Swales, these are not the playing fields of Eton, I'm afraid.
Still, I never thought you'd Welsh.
Oh, dear me, I'm not Welshing. You can have your money now, this very hour.